Subcommittee on Human Services, I don't know what day today is, Tuesday?
February 10th.
February 10th, where's the time go? It's Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, House Bill 5026, this is a public hearing. Would you like to lead us through this first?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, yesterday you heard an agency overview from Director Aaron Kelly Seal, and today the first program area is here to start. I'm giving you some more detailed information about programs. It's the Aging and People with Disabilities program.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Did you all have your coffee?
Yes.
You're excused. Go ahead, get started.
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here this morning. We're excited to kick off these series of detailed presentations from the Department of Human Services. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the Director of the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. To my right.
Good morning, Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham. I'm the Deputy Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services.
And for the record, I'm Eric Moore, Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services.
Okay, Tamara?
I'm Tamara Brickman from the Chief Financial Office.
Okay, thank you. So I always like to begin these presentations with the policy statement that is contained in ORS 410. This statement was passed in 1981 and is still as relevant today as it was at that time. It's remarkable how aligned and committed our stakeholders, our partners are to fulfilling and seeing through this vision that was articulated in ORS 410. So the Department of Human Services, along with most state agencies, participated in the 10-year planning process with the governor. And as part of that process, the Aging and People with Disabilities Program established a set of goals. The first one, invest in preventative services so that only 3% of Oregonians 65 and older will need access to publicly funded long-term care services. This goal statement is not about restricting access to services for seniors. This is about building an infrastructure of preventative services in Oregon that prevent the needs for seniors to access the Medicaid system. And I think we've made some really good steps over the last 2 years. You can see the current statistics. We are at 3.13% of Oregonians age 65 or older, that are accessing the Medicaid-funded long-term care system, down from 3.4% in 2012. Our next goal, remove barriers so that 50% of individuals accessing long-term care services receive those services in their own homes. So there are a lot of barriers around people being able to be successful in their own homes, and the legislature made a lot of investments to break down those barriers in the last session. So the current statistics, we are at 49.6%, up from 38.4% in December 2012. So we've really moved this needle in the last 2 years. The next one, increase our ability of our home and community-based service system to serve individuals with high-intensity needs so that only 10% of the individuals we're serving will need those in an institution or a nursing facility. And the current statistics, we're at 13.6% of all people served are being served in nursing facilities, down from 16.1% in December 2012.
Chair, may I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Is it okay to do it while they're going?
It's up to them.
Do you prefer us to hold questions? Or do you have any dollar savings associated with the figure of more people in home? And I'm assuming for the same level of care, same capacity.
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, we have we can do that analysis quite easily for you. I do not have it handy with me today, but let me get that information back to you, in the next few days. So the Aging and People with Disabilities program really operates off the social model of services. This principle is fundamental and extremely important to our entire stakeholder community. So it begins by, you know, conducting a holistic assessment of a person's needs. It considers things like housing, food security, environmental barriers, and what goes into that is a service plan that is meets the needs and preferences of that individual. Where there are natural supports in play, like say a neighbor or a family member, those resources are incorporated into the service plan as long as the individuals are willing. And ultimately the service plan is finalized, and then what we're authorizing in the end is the public payment portion of that service plan. This is the current state of affairs of the Oregonians that we are serving through our programs. 360,000 through the Older Americans Act and Oregon Project Independence. This was intended to be kind of that light touch of services, light package of services, that gives that little bit of help to keep people independent in their own homes. The next one, financial eligibility. We continue to do all of the eligibility determinations for seniors and people with disabilities in the following programs. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps. Medicaid, Health Oregon Health Plan eligibility for seniors and people with disabilities. We have this slice that we're still doing in our local offices, while the other 850,000 are being done by the Oregon Health Authority today. Individuals who need assistance with paying their Medicare premiums, we call those the Medicare Savings Programs. We provide the eligibility for that program. Those are the major categories in which we determine financial eligibility. The next category, this is our future vision for how we're going to serve Oregonians, is through a single point of contact, a no-wrong-door approach referred to as the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. Ashley will be talking about this a little bit more in depth further in the presentation, but we're recently served 68,000 unique Oregonians through that service. And then here's the breakout of our Medicaid-funded long-term care program, 15,000 in-home, 12,000 through community-based care, which includes settings such as adult foster homes, assisted living facilities, and residential care facilities, and finally approximately 4,000 people through nursing facility. This is the trend over time, and I really like this chart because it shows that what I believe is that we're on the right track. You can see this, the scale of this, all of this adds to one, and it shows the percentage of the individuals we're serving, where they're at points of time. So you can see our percentage of in-home that we're serving has grown considerably. Community-based care is somewhat stable, and nursing facility utilization is on a steady but undisputable downward trend. We've also included the cost, the average cost per case. This is the gross cost associated with these services. In a lot of our programs, consumers have to contribute towards the cost of their services above a certain level of their income.
So this is our Aging and Disability Network. This slide is designed to show you how Oregonians can access our services. So we have regional aging and people with disabilities offices, and then we also have, as part of the network, independent area agencies on aging. And of the independent area agencies on aging, which a lot of times is we refer to them as AAAs, there are type A's and type B's. And the type A's mostly provide our Older Americans Act and Oregon Project Independence services. And the type B's have the ability to also do Medicaid, Adult Protective Services, and they also do Older Americans Act and OPI services. And this sort of structure for the Aging and Disability Network was part of the vision established or started back in 1965, so that older adults could have access to health and community-based services in their own communities.
Any questions there? I'd like to have, later on in the session, we're going to have a discussion about type A TFEs. This is an old system. It's very confusing. Even people trying to describe it to others, it's confusing. So we'd like to get a little deeper in that at a later time.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe this is exactly that, but I always thought that when you were on Medicare, that's what took care of your medical needs. And it's just that
there
now,
are
and there's
Medicare and Medicaid programs at times have programs called dual eligibles. If you're a low enough income and you're in Medicare, then you also qualify for Medicaid supplementation of that. So they pay your premium, they pay your prescriptions. So you're dual eligible and covers both sides, okay?
So the Medicaid picks up.
Yeah. And obviously some Medicaid people don't qualify for Medicare, either not been disabled long enough or they're not 65 years old. Okay. So there's a mixture of programs there.
It's a Venn diagram.
It's a what?
It's a Venn diagram. There's Medicaid people, there's Medicare people, and then there's an overlapping subset of the two.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
That's on the healthcare side.
Right.
This is on long-term housing,
care.
Basically, and other issues too. You know, food.
But with the advent, if I may, Mr. Chair, with the advent of the CCOs and Medicaid starting to pick up, think about more than just the traditional healthcare services. It's even more important for our older, more indigent seniors to have access to both sets of services because the CCOs can help with some of this as well.
We'd like to have a longer discussion about A's and B's, whether they're appropriate anymore.
Okay.
Very complex.
We welcome that discussion.
Yes.
Senator.
It was 19. I didn't know it was 1965, but that's nice to hear. Yeah.
Okay. So, in order to qualify for long-term care, which we're trying to transition to referring to long-term care as our long-term services and supports, individuals need to meet two sets of criteria. First of all, they have to be financially eligible, and their income can go up to approximately $2,200 per month, and they have to have needs and activities of daily living. So for our new members who haven't seen this chart, you'll notice that our eligibility criteria is based upon an individual's ability to perform activities of daily living. You're not seeing on here diabetes, you're not seeing congestive heart failure, any types of medical conditions. This is really the implementation of the social model in how services should be administered to keep people independent, healthy, and safe. So today, the Medicaid system is covering service priority levels 1 through 13. If an individual has one of those priority levels plus their income qualifies, they are determined eligible for Medicaid. Through our Oregon Project Independence Program, they cover through service priority levels 18. So that's the reason for the difference in these colors. Previously, the state did cover all service priority levels through the Medicaid system, and it was either 2003 or 2005 that the reduction came to cut it off at service priority level 13.
Any questions? That was a pretty big decision at that point in the middle of the recession. And I don't know if we should reconsider that, look at it also. Also, we found a lot of people who used to be at level 15, 16, or 17 were reclassified into 12 by looking at them carefully. So I'm not sure how much actual movement there was there. And I don't think other states use this kind of a system. Is that true?
That co-chairs, that is my understanding, that our system is somewhat unique. Okay, so to say that we've received a lot of stuff thrown at us this biennium is an understatement. It has come fast and furiously at us, and we, I believe we've done a really excellent job at establishing order off of all of these new initiatives and investments the legislature has made. When you really boil it down, I think there are four goals that all of the new initiatives fall into. So the first one is about improving access to services for Oregonians. And here's a summary of some of the initiatives that we implemented this biennium. that further that goal. The next, focus on preventative services, to help ensure that seniors and people with disabilities don't need more expensive services either through the Medicaid program or through institutions. And so these are some of the programs that we've implemented this biennium that focus on prevention. The next one is increasing the services that consumers receive. And we have a lot of initiatives here that are designed to meet that goal. And finally, promote quality service delivery amongst our local office, our contracted partners, and our providers in how they administer services to or all Oregonians. And this is a summary of the initiatives that we initiated this biennium towards that goal.
Any questions?
Just a newbie question. Some of these acronyms, I have no clue what they mean. So.
I apologize. Agree to get. I can either do them now, or I can agree to provide them in writing.
Do it now.
Oh. Okay. Let's go back. So the CMS is the first acronym. I apologize for this. That's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or the Feds that oversee the Medicaid programs in Oregon. CCOs, Coordinated Care Organizations. PACE is the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly program. This is an option that is made available by CMS, and currently Oregon only has one contractor who's a PACE provider, and that's Providence Elder Place in Portland. The K plan I will be discussing a little bit later in my presentation. HCBS are the Home and Community-Based Services Regulations, and my peer, Lilia Tennedy, and I will be giving a detailed presentation on both the Home and Community-Based Services Regulations as well as the new regulations from the Department of Labor on Monday the 16th. IADL, that's Instrumental Activities of Daily Living. So these are things like meal preparation, things like housekeeping and money management services. NIF is Nursing Facility. PASS-R, Pre-Admission Screening for Residents, and I forgot the last R.
The reason I asked him to go through them because I don't know after 14 okay. years. And that was not a newbie question. That was a very good question. Okay?
Maybe we can get a glossary or whatever you call it.
I think if people just as they came up for the committee and would just tell us what they are as they go through would be very helpful. Because I don't know them all either.
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, I am going to follow up with something easier to understand on this slide. I apologize.
We need the return of Senator Winter's acronym jar.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question, though, because it's kind of germane to something we're talking here about. And it's a problem to have both an OHA and a DHS, and that's enrollment and qualifications. You mentioned ADRC, a way of going through something that there's no wrong door for people coming in. How broad is that? And you can give me that answer later. How broad is that? Can you get on Medicaid? Can you get into the right program you need as a disabled person or as an aging senior? We need one place for people to walk in, and we've actually gone backwards on this. DHS workers were cut off from doing Medicaid enrollment a year and a half ago, and it's really led to some problems. So we want no wrong door for Oregonians walking in, and I'd like to hear more about that later. It's a problem for both agencies.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, that's an excellent question, and I think Ashley's going to talk about that a little bit farther, deeper later in the presentation.
Thank you.
So this slide talks a little bit about some of the work that we're doing that goes outside of DHS as an agency, and we work with other agencies. You may remember that Erin Kelly Seal yesterday mentioned that it's really important to us as an agency to make sure that we're working with other agencies because we know that we can better serve Oregonians. So these are four examples of some of the work that our program has been doing with other agencies. So the first one is partnering with the Oregon Health Authority to increase coordination and quality between our coordinated care organizations and the provision of long-term care services and supports out in the communities all across the state. The second one is that our program's been leading an aging populations implementation team for the Governor's Prison Reentry Council. So Oregon has a very high number of older adults who are incarcerated, and they are serving their sentences and they're ready to transition back into the community. And so our program helps them, especially the people with very high needs, long-term services and supports needs, get successfully transitioned back into the community. We also have just begun work on a housing with services work group, and that includes several different other state entities, Housing and Community Services, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and the State Fire Marshal's Office. So we're going to be looking to make sure that the appropriate level of consumer protections are in place for vulnerable people who are living in housing with services establishments. And then the last example is partnering with community colleges on training and job development for our health workers and personal health navigators.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
May I? Thank you. Actually, I'm curious, getting back to the reentry part of it for that group of people, what's the population? I mean, how many people are coming out like that? I'm curious.
Co-chairs, Representative Olson. It's really not that high of a volume, so I think, you know, it's about probably under 30 a year that are the really high needs population, the ones that really need intensive support, and that requires the most collaboration between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services. But we expect a lot of older adults who may not have that high level of needs, but because they've been in the prison system, they experience accelerated aging, and so they might need some level of supports more along the spectrum of our Older Americans Act services or our Oregon Project Independent services when they're coming back into the community. But I'd be happy to provide you with the actual numbers from the Department of Corrections.
You don't need to, that's fine.
Okay.
So how does that play out with community corrections?
Community corrections, and forgive me, I'm very new to this subject, but community corrections is involved in our aging implementation team. And so I think the way it works is that our local Area Agency on Aging or our APD office work closely with community corrections to make sure that if someone is leaving, say, Salem and going back to Klamath Falls, they would be working with the community corrections program in Klamath Falls to make sure everything is in place before the person is back in that community.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, it's an interesting topic and one we need a little more information on. If you sit in the agencies on the corrections side, we have an unknown number of elderly prisoners mm-hmm. who have extremely high medical needs. They're serving out their sentences. They probably are no longer a danger to society because they can't get around and do anything. They could be using $100,000, $150,000 a year of medical services that we pay for as a state, whereas if we got them out of prison and got them out of adjudication, we could put them into the Medicare and Medicaid plans, which are supported by the federal government, not by general fund dollars. So it is a pertinent discussion.
It's a huge issue.
And the question is whether or not those people can be released early, either through a pardon or some other method, and still not be a danger to society.
Right.
And then the savings are huge. It's a very strange situation in our country. If you want the best possible medical care, get yourself in prison, and your state will pay for it. Come out, and we have a partnership with the federal government. So it's an important decision, yeah. And it really affects the corrections budget tremendously. I think that's what you're talking about here, really. That's what we're trying to get to.
Big.
So I like to know who those 30 people are that are coming out, who they are, what they look like, not by individual, obviously, but kind of what they look like. What's their age? How serious are their medical conditions? Some picture of that, and we'll take that back to corrections and have that discussion.
Right? I like
Mr.
it.
Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. You know, thinking about this makes me wonder, too, whether if we couldn't commute sentences or do something else like that for these individuals, whether it would be possible to create some alternative kind of facility that wouldn't qualify as true imprisonment and therefore they wouldn't lose their federal benefits, but would protect, you know, if we had real concerns or if they were Measure 11 situations where we couldn't do something. I think it's an opportunity for us to start to get a little creative because just like the rest of us, aging baby boomers, we've got a lot of aging baby boomers in our correction system. And I think the other thing we have to bear in mind is that not only does it cost the state a lot more, that's money that we can't put into education and other core services that we think are important. So I just think we have some real opportunities to think about this a little differently.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, follow up what the Senator just said, and Ashley, that's a great point she just brought up. Of those that do come out for reentry, I would imagine an extremely high majority of those are Measure 11. So it'd be interesting to know what crimes they're serving sentence on.
And I think it's another medical condition, so we can have some idea if they're really still a danger to society.
Yeah.
I know we have one, apparently we have one case of somebody on a respirator right now inside the correction systems.
Right.
It's in there on Measure 11.
Really,
this man cannot go anywhere. He's hooked up to a machine to breathe, and it costs $150,000 a year to maintain him in prison.
Yeah.
Or if he's outside, there'd be no cost to state at all, except for some Medicaid costs. So those kind of things have to be brought into control.
Yeah.
Co-chairs, members of the committee.
Representative.
Oh, pardon me.
I just wanted to weigh into this and say that I think we need to be cognizant of the crime committed, so that you're not letting out, violent sexual act by an older person who happens to be medically fragile or whatever, because that I think it sends the wrong message. But I get what you're saying about
And I agree. The first question has to be asked, are they a danger to society anymore?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's the first question. If they're not, why are we spending all this money on them? We could move them someplace else and frankly save money for the state that can be used for other programs. Sorry for the interruption. No. Representative Olson and I both sit on corrections, and he's been involved a long time with, so we're very interested.
So welcome to judiciary.
Yeah. and I think Representative Katie Dyer, are you on that?
I've not
got my committees completely straight in my head. You're not on that one?
Nope.
Full ways and means. Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
It's actually
co-chairs.
Sorry.
I was just going to say it's actually a really important point, which is that this is why it's great when we have members who serve on multiple subcommittees or who bring different policy expertise to a subcommittee that's not the same policy area. I think it's great.
We have interlocking committees, but sometimes they get confused with who's on which, so I apologize. Okay. Please continue.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'd be happy to work with corrections and bring back the data that you've requested on the Measure 11 crimes or crimes committed, and also the medical conditions of the people who are coming out, and any other information that you're interested in around our aging populations implementation team. I'm happy to provide it to you.
Okay, thank you. So now we'd like to walk through some of our major accomplishments in this last biennium. In the last legislative session, there was a robust dialogue about whether Oregon should pursue the Community First Choice option, also known as the K plan. I need to make sure that all members realize that the K plan impacts equally both the Aging and People with Disabilities Program as well as the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program. I can tell you that the challenges on implementing the K plan are significantly different amongst the two programs. So today I'm going to be giving you the perspective from the Aging and People with Disabilities Program, and frankly, it was a much easier transition for the APD system to move into the K plan than it was the Developmental Disabilities Program. And this really was an APD-led initiative that they were pulled along with. So some highlights in this biennium, both the actual and the projected for the remaining the remainder of the biennium. Additional federal funding from the K plan amounts to $144 million that we've brought in to help seniors and people with disabilities. I think that my personal opinion is that Oregon is extremely well positioned for the future. When you consider that we are getting, we're only investing about 31 cents of every dollar that is spent instead of 37 cents without the K plan, that turns into very large dollars over the long term. And with the aging demographic that is coming, I think that Oregon is positioned very well. The K plan is also offered a new package of benefits that are available to help consumers stay in their own homes. I'd like to give you a few real life examples of this. So a 57-year-old man with repeated hospitalizations due to serious recurring cellulitis, his condition prevented him from keeping his house tidy. It was literally getting less and less sanitary on a daily basis to the point where the home was no longer safe. So the K plan allowed us to come in and provide intensive cleaning services as part of his rehabilitation, and then support the man with a service plan that would keep the house clean in the future. So that investment to prevent, you know, future hospitalizations and creating a more safe environment for the individual only cost $200 in state general funds. So that was a very smart investment. A more intensive example.
I'm going to stop you
yes.
there. I'm going to ask Senator Steiner Haywood to talk about cellulitis and what it would be like living with cellulitis in your home and unable to keep your house clean, and what it would look like for that patient going in and out of the hospital. You've seen a million of these cases.
I have indeed seen a million of these cases. So just to, it's the medical equivalent of abbreviation. Cellulitis is a skin infection, basically, is the most simple way of looking at it. It can be caused by a range of different bacteria, and some people are more prone to it for one reason or another. We see it often in people who are very obese, who have trouble because they get little yeast infections in what are called intertriginous, or in between the skin folds. We see it in people with bad athlete's foot because they harbor bacteria in their legs and then they get it. We see it with people who have problems with blood return to the heart because they don't clear out the fluid in their lower legs well. And if you have somebody like that, it can limit their mobility, because when someone has cellulitis, one of the things we tell them to do is to keep that part of their body elevated above the heart as much as possible, which makes it pretty tough to walk unless it's on your forehead, in which case we have other problems. And then it's hard to walk around, which means that it's hard to keep your house tidy, which means that you're more set up to poor physical activity because it's hard to navigate around your house, which also increases your risk for cellulitis, and you have poor hygiene conditions, which makes you more prone to cellulitis. And as you can imagine, it turns into a rather vicious cycle here. And so these kinds of interventions, the ability to provide these traditionally non-medical, quote-unquote, services are, in fact, critically important medical interventions. So having the K plan gives us enormous opportunity to actually meet the health needs and promote health rather than treat illness in our aging people with disabilities community, which I think is critically important. And that's, I mean, if you go back to the very first slide you showed, where we talked about the mission for our older people in this state, our vision of how they should be living, this is what the K plan allows us to do. This is what, for our Medicaid population, to some extent, the CCOs are allowing us to do, to actually do things that promote health. Was that what you sort of hoped for there,
Mr.
Chair?
Yeah, one more thing I'll add.
Yeah,
I was waiting for you to say, but I forgot to. People with chronic cellulitis probably are hospitalized at least once a year.
At least.
Usually for a week and a half. $50,000 to $75,000.
Yep.
So you not only saved a lot of money for this person and it made his life better, but you save the healthcare system probably $50,000 to $75,000.
Yeah, for every hospitalization.
Every time you went in. And I've had patients with this kind of stuff going in two or three times a year.
At least.
Huge savings.
At least.
So well done. Question.
Thank you. So in that vein, does the K plan allow for more than like household cleaning, but actually linking people up to a health gym or walking them around the block or those kinds of things that would keep them healthy? I'm thinking about the underlying causes of the cellulitis and how you get at that.
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, it doesn't allow for that specific service you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of flexibilities within the K plan that allow us to ensure that the environment in which the person operates is safe and they have an adequate service plan that allows them to remain safe in their own homes or communities. So the next two examples I'm going to give you are radically different than the first one. The first one is a young man that was in a car accident and experienced quadriplegia. He was rehabilitating in a nursing facility. He could not return home because the house was not accessible to him. So the K plan allowed us to authorize the environmental modifications, which allowed that home to become accessible to him so that he can continue to live there. You know, it's somewhat of a significant investment up front, but it'll pay dividends in the long term when compared to the cost of nursing facility services. The last one is a 67-year-old woman with an acquired brain injury, discharged home after surgery. She couldn't manage her own medications. They were talking about putting this person into a 24-hour residential setting simply for this reason, because she couldn't manage her medications. So what we did through the K plan was we purchased a locking medication dispenser that's tied to an emergency response system. This costs us $75 per month. The home care worker for this individual fills the dispenser on a weekly basis, and it opens only at the appropriate time. And if the individual doesn't take the medication, it sounds an alert, you know, that the medication still needs to be taken. And we've invested actually quite a bit of money into medication management machines throughout our system for many consumers. So you can see the kind of the flexibility, but we haven't gone into kind of things like exercise or anything like that yet.
Sure. Question.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Bates. A couple questions on just the K plan overall and its predictability of what it would actually cost. I understand that the feds do a huge match, and I thought it was something like 70% that they match, or that they pay out and we pay 30. But a couple, I was reading an article on this the other day, and it talked about, especially with DD services, that many clients are able to go from previously accessing about $20,000 worth of services up to $90,000 worth of services. And one of the challenges that some of these individuals have been facing is the lack of or a shortage of providers. They now have the ability to pay for these services, but because there's so many people who now have that ability to pay to receive those services, there aren't enough providers for that. So with as new as this is, not knowing how many people have actually utilized the difference in that increase in eligibility benefits and how many people were able to access the providers, how do we actually predict what this would really cost us moving forward?
Co-chairs, Representative Stark, I learned a lesson a long time ago that every time I try and talk about the DD program, I get in trouble. I can tell you that the DD program will be giving their presentation next week and is significantly better versed on this topic than I am. I am aware that there are struggles with implementation on the DD side. It's kind of looking more like an APD system. I can also acknowledge that across all of our programs, we are experiencing workforce shortages. In some areas, the shortages are severe. Cheryl Miller, who is the director of our Oregon Home Care Commission, has recently launched a project in collaboration with stakeholders, local partners, SEIU, to build a plan to enhance this workforce, build new workforce. The compensation for home care workers and personal support workers is has really risen dramatically over the last few years. Someone can support a middle income household with the compensation that's received from that. And so we really need to, you know, be partnering and outreaching with the right people to attract more people into this this occupation, which frankly is going, the need is going to continue to increase even without the K plan. So I know that wasn't the most articulate answer to your question. May I help you with anything else at this point?
Can you hold that question till next week when DD is here?
That's great.
Okay. I think it's a great question. Workforce development is happening across the state as quickly as we can. Community colleges and other areas are working on it. We're actually opening up an area that's going to be, I think, part of our growth in our new economy as people age out. I remember being on a task force on aging 10 years ago, and we had no idea how we're going to take care of this aging population. And through the K plan and the home plans we have, OPI, and ELFs and other organizations, we've actually stepped up and done a good job. We're one of the few states that really saw this wave coming and are working towards. There's still lots of things to do yet.
Minor question, but does K stand for anything?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, it's an artifact of the feds. It's this section in their regulations called 1915, and they go C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and J, and K was the next one unused, and that's how it got its, we've shortened it. The official name is the Community First Choice Option. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
So it's okay.
I just want to point out that the fact that Oregon got this waiver, got this K plan, is really, again, evidence of how our state is being very forward-thinking. I mean, the fact that we put that statement in our statute so many decades ago about what we believe, how we believe seniors should be living, which is very different from how many other states were thinking about that four decades ago. We understand in this state that we have to do things differently to give people higher quality of life and to meet sort of a broader version of the triple aim, which in healthcare is that, you know, better care, better outcomes, lower costs. But in this kind of situation is more independence, more self-determination for our seniors, more in-home services, better quality of life at lower costs. And it requires a great deal of imagination and willingness to put up with an enormous amount of federal bureaucracy and dotting of I's and crossing of T's. And I really want to commend the agency for pursuing this. It's going to make a big difference for Oregon seniors. It already is.
How many of you were on this committee last session? I know Representative Nathanson was. You were. Anybody else?
Negative.
Okay. Just so you know a little history, the K plan waiver was not without really serious controversy. Mm-hmm. We didn't make that decision probably till more than halfway through the session of whether we should go for the K waiver or not. We weren't sure how much money was involved, and the agencies were really concerned of whether or not they had the capability of moving forward with it once it came in. There were so many unanswered questions, it was a big change for everybody. I think I'm guessing what we'll see of the DD population, they're probably having a little more difficulty with it. Ultimately, the long-term goal is the right way to go, but it's a big change, a lot of money involved. Frankly, we used some of that money to balance the budget last time and open up more services. So just to be perfectly honest, it was not without controversy. There were some real questions of whether we should do it or not. I believed it was the right decision then, and I still do now. And I wanted it not so much for balancing the budget as for opening up more services. But there was a big controversy. You may remember that. And so I want you to understand what we're walking through here is not like a done deal. We're all like kumbaya last time about it. It was very, very controversial.
No. So I hate to ask this because it might be too big of a question for the time we have, but I wonder if you could just briefly say what it is the K plan replaced, other than it, we owed 37% as opposed to 31%, so there's a savings in cost. What was the overall structure that preceded the K plan?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, the K plan replaced, for the most part, a series of waivers that were operated in the Aging and People with Disabilities and Developmental Disabilities programs. The waivers had defined services, which were more restrictive than the services that are available under the K plan. And the biggest difference would be that it incentivized states to move their systems towards home and community-based services through the enhanced federal match rate. In Oregon, it's the comparison of 63% versus 69%. So they provided that incentive because, I mean, Oregon, for the members who aren't aware of this, Oregon still is, you know, one of the best, if not the best, long-term care systems in Oregon. Most states are still envious of where we are, and so the community first choice option provided a powerful incentive for states that were unbalanced to rebalance using that additional federal funding. We didn't have that problem. It presented an opportunity for us for additional federal revenue, additional investment in our programs, and that's pretty much how we implemented it.
It was basically additional, it was an enhancement.
And okay. It's only then the enhanced rate is only for the home-based services, or no?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. So it nursing facility services are the regular federal match rate. Mm-hmm. Pretty much, I'm generalizing, but as a general rule, almost everything else that APD is paying for programmatically out of the Medicaid system receives the enhanced federal match rate. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's continue. We're
still working. So this is a summary of some of the investments the legislature made over the course of this biennium. Of course, several members have extensive experience with the senior special purpose appropriation for seniors. There was a great new investment in adult protective services. I'm going to get more into mental health services and the accomplishments that we have this biennium. Provider rates, it appears as if our provider base is relatively stable at this point. We have good access through the Medicaid system. We made a ton of improvements to the services that in-home consumers received. You've invested in options counseling services out of our aging and disability resource connections, and you authorized the establishment of an innovations fund. So last biennium, we had almost equal amount of discussions about how APD can help with reducing the census at the Oregon State Hospital. So for those of you who aren't aware, the Oregon State Hospital has what's commonly referred to as a GERO unit. At the time, it was four wings that served individuals, seniors, and people with disabilities with severe and persistent mental illness, you know, requiring institutionalization, also a neurological unit. There was a significant investment made by the legislature on both the addictions and mental health side as well as the aging and people with disability side. One of the expectations passed was that reduce the wings from four to three. We partnered with Addictions and Mental Health on accomplishing that. It closed in March 29th of 2014. You can see when an individual, this graph is very telling, when an individual is stabilized and ready for a community placement, they are determined ready to transition. And so you can think of the clock starts ticking at that point. How much money are we spending in the state hospital that we should otherwise be spending in the community? So the average number of days in December 2012 was 83 days until that an individual received their community placement. We've got that down to 51 and a half. We still have a lot of work to do on this, but we're heading in the right direction, in my opinion. Some other statistics, individuals at the state hospital who were deemed eligible for aging and people with disabilities programs. Discharges, 32 individuals in 2012. In 2014, we transitioned 47. That's an increase of 47% from previously. So I think we still have work to do, but I think we're on the right track, and we do have a pretty strong partnership with Addictions and Mental Health on trying to improve this situation.
Questions? I have a couple questions real quick, and this will help with the other committee members that haven't been here before. What's the average cost per year for a patient in the state hospital?
Co-Chair Bates, I'm going to have to get back to you with the answer to that question.
I believe it's about $240,000. I think that's
Somewhere that's really close.
Pretty close to that. And there's no, and for the most cases, I think there's no general, it's all general fund, there's no match by federal government?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're transferring people or transitioning them out to beds in the public outside of the hospital, and I assume in a safe and satisfactory way. These are usually geriatric patients with major medical and emotional problems. Am I correct on that?
Yes, Co-Chair Bates, you are.
And most of them are Medicare eligible? Or Medicaid eligible?
Co-Chair Bates, definitely Medicaid eligible. I'm assuming Medicare, but I can't say that as a factual statement.
Okay. This program of transferring out, we've been working on it for 3 or 4 years. Representative Nathanson's been a big part of helping us with this. The state hospital is necessary, but it's not where we want these people to be. There's a more humane way of helping them at a fraction of the cost, and so I appreciate the work you're doing here. Please keep pushing that program forward.
And I'd also like to thank our colleagues at the state hospital who have really been great partners on this as well.
I wonder how these things ever came about. I mean, just and the inertia is amazing.
The next big initiative we discussed last session, House Bill 2216. This was a bill that incentivized nursing facilities to right-size themselves using a series of incentives and disincentives. It also eliminated all exemptions for the nursing facility provider assessment. You may hear it referred to as a provider tax. It's a provider assessment that's applicable to all nursing facilities with the exception of those operated by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. So here's where we're at. The bed reduction, we have reduced most current statistics. 280 beds have been removed. We're at 18.7% of our goal. I wish that I had better statistics to report on this, but I do know that there are continuing conversations about this, and I can attest that I have done numerous meetings with the provider community on this topic about looking at their local service capacity, discussing community needs and options for special contracting in the event that the facilities wanted to repurpose themselves, for example, to serve seniors with, you know, severe mental illness. Here's a snapshot of how the nursing facility assessment revenue has changed. That first time period, January 2013 through June 2013, generated $20.8 million. Fast forward a year after the assessments were eliminated, it's up to 26.8 or up 28.8%. These are the biennial figures. 81.9 million in the 11-13 biennium. This biennium, which includes both actuals and projected revenue for the remainder of the biennium, 104.3 million, up 27.3%. That investment of that additional revenue is what allows us to pay the nursing facilities at the rate they're being reimbursed today. So for every dollar put into this program through provider assessments, it decreases the amount of state general fund that's needed to match the federal funds on that. So it's a direct offset to state general fund, the nursing facility provider assessment.
Yeah, are people familiar with this? You'll be seeing a similar program in OHA.
Okay, now we're going to turn to some of the parts of our program that are really designed to serve the entire older adult and people with physical disabilities population in the state. So as Mike mentioned earlier, we have our Aging and Disability Resource Connection. And this serves as a single point of entry. The vision is for it to be a single point of entry for information about long-term services and supports for Oregonians across the state. So I'm sure many of you have experienced with your own families a situation where a parent or a grandparent has a crisis situation arise and you know you need some level of support to assist that person, but it can be really confusing on where you turn to get which types of services. And so I know in my family it occurred after my grandmother had a couple of different health incidents and ended up in the hospital several times, but you know, she really wanted to remain in her home. So we didn't know exactly where to call. The Aging and Disability Resource Connection is supposed to try to help you when you find yourself in that situation. And it's designed also to raise awareness about all of the variety of types of services that are available through existing infrastructure in your communities. And so this can be something really simple. It could be before a crisis situation arises, and someone just wants to know where their local senior center is. And the ADRC can help connect a consumer to their local senior center for, say, a congregate meal, or, you know, community meal where everyone can gather together to eat. Or it could be something really complex, like grandma or grandpa or mom is in a nursing facility and she really wants to get back home. And so the ADRC would walk through a process to help ensure that they could transition, this person could transition from the nursing home back into the community or a different type of setting that was more in line with what they wanted. So right now we have 9 different regions that make up our Aging and Disability Resource Connection. And this happens through local coordination and integration of the existing services framework in that area. And right now the big participants, which you know we hope will expand over time, but the big participants right now are our area agencies on aging and our APD offices and then our Centers for Independent Living. And so they continue to work together to try to realize this vision that we've embarked on through our Aging and Disability Resource Connection. So this slide just shows you some of our statistics currently. These are numbers of calls, website hits, and we continue to gain momentum. And as we do that, we need to make refinements to the system, and so we're focusing on that. The fourth bullet down talks about options counseling. It's something Mike mentioned earlier. This is something that there's been a big investment in, and options counseling is a really person-centered process to make sure that a person is able to develop a plan that really aligns with what their needs are, what their preferences are for long-term services and supports. And a critical component is that options counselor has gone through that process with a consumer, they follow up later with that consumer or their family to ensure that they have, in fact, connected to some of those services and supports and they're getting what they need in their community. And through our evaluation process of our options counseling program, we've heard that a great number of Oregonians feel that they've achieved a lot greater independence through going through this options counseling process.
Yes. Question, Chair? Two questions. One is, how do you connect with 211? Do they try to do a lot of the referrals directly to aging services, or do they just automatically refer to you? And second question is, do you provide any of this bilingually?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer. I'm going to have to follow up with you to see exactly how the connection is made to 211, unless Mike can speak to it. But I know that we do have some level of connection, but I want to be able to provide you with all of the details. And my understanding is that 211 is more of direct referral, and I think they do refer to the ADRC, the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. And the difference being is that the Aging and Disability Resource Connection process goes a little bit deeper through this counseling process and really makes sure the connection is made for the consumer to the services.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So my interest here would be to make sure there's not a duplicative service, that if there's an agreement actually between 211 and you, that they may save themselves a lot of training and work referring people to services that they could do with one number if you then go into more detail.
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer. Yes, I think that's an excellent point, and I know some work has been done in the past, and we recently, 211 reached out to us to discuss this very collaboration and coordination, and we plan to be meeting with them very soon to talk about that.
Great.
And then I think, yes, the answer to your other question, do we provide information in different languages? I believe that we do, but I will double check and bring that information back to you. Okay, so moving on to safety and protection. This is incredibly important to our program, and we protect people through a variety of ways, but today I'm just going to focus on two of the main ways that we're able to ensure people's safety. One is through licensing, and this slide shows you our three different license setting types through our program. So nursing facilities, assisted living, residential care, and adult foster homes. The numbers show the total capacity, and that that number includes both private pay individuals and individuals who are Medicaid long-term services and supports consumers. And so we license facilities regardless of payer. So if you're paying out of pocket to live there, or our Medicaid system is paying, it's licensed the same way. And then through licensing, we work closely with facilities because we want to make sure facilities are able to meet the residents' needs. And especially in our community-based care settings, we want to ensure that the facilities are providing choice and a home-like environment within that facility. Additionally, we work closely with our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight and outside our agency with the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to identify gaps in the system and then create system-wide improvements. And most recently, we've all been collaborating together to work on a tool that could be used to better evaluate whether staffing levels are meeting all of the needs of the residents within facilities.
Mr. Chair.
You mentioned the phrase gaps in the system. Are you referring to gaps in safety and protection or some other gaps?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I think that the gaps can be a variety of things, but yes, in this instance, the gap that I'm talking about is within the context of licensing. So if we know that a facility is supposed to be following a certain rule under to be licensed as that setting type, and we see that they're repeatedly not able to meet that requirement, then we need to take further action. And so the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman can be really helpful in bringing forward resident complaints around licensing issues. Mm-hmm. And then our licensing, Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight and our program can be more proactive in working with facilities.
Thank you. What I'm hearing from you is an expression of the need for adequate identification of problems and then enforcement action. I didn't hear what kind of gaps there may be in the system itself, but certainly enforcement and follow-up is important. When I was wondering about gaps, that also made me wonder, well, what about overlaps? There's licensing, but there's probably licensing, oversight, and auditing by more than one agency or more than one work unit, and sometimes I'm very interested in seeing what that overlap is, because sometimes organizations are subjected to multiple audits or multiple visits, and sometimes we can do better. We can actually spend more time on concentrated review and enforcement if we didn't spend as much time as we do spinning wheels doing multiple audits. Have you identified any opportunities that there may be in that regard?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I can't think of examples right at this moment, but we have started working regularly with our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, plus our Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation to make sure that
we're discussing any issues that arise and then coming up with streamlined measures to make sure that we're meeting the residents' needs and that there isn't overlap, and to make it a lot more clear to Oregonians, you know, who's responsible for handling which piece or which, you know, issue within a facility. So I can bring back some of that information to you about what we are identifying and the measures that we're taking.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Mike, did you want to say something?
Co-Chair Nathanson, there may be overlap in surveys that occur between the state and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but I'm not positive of that, and I'm making a note to check on that when we get back to the office as well.
Any other questions?
Okay, turning now to adult protective services. This is another one of the ways that we're able to protect Oregonians. So you've likely heard a lot about elder abuse over the years. In Oregon, we define elder or adult abuse as abuse of any older adult, or an adult 65 or older, and adults with developmental physical disabilities or mental illness under the age of 65. And as you can see on this slide, here's just some of the examples. This is not an exhaustive list, but physical harm or injury, verbal emotional abuse, financial exploitation, involuntary seclusion, and self-neglect. Financial exploitation is one of the abuse types that continues to grow, okay. And along with financial... Oh, pardon me?
I'm so sorry to keep interrupting you, but this does... bring up a question. You know, we mentioned earlier about the parallels with the K waiver and CCOs, but isolation makes me think about the fact that a lot of older adults end up with psychiatric problems such as anxiety that manifests as agoraphobia, things like that. And I'm wondering a little bit about, and this may not be the best time to talk about how you guys are dovetailing between the mental health services and the other kinds of services that you're providing for older adults. Obviously, abuse is part of that, and that has its own separate implications. If this isn't the best time to talk about it, I'm happy to take a rain check on that question.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, what's ironic about this is that most seniors say they want to live in their own homes. And then the unfortunate...
I'm so sorry. I have an elderly mother. This is...
Okay.
Her ears were burning.
Sometimes the seniors do end up isolated. I think that we need to do a better job of developing kind of more community integration activities to prevent isolation. There's also been a significant amount of discussion over the last 2 years about the administration of mental health services to seniors and people with disabilities. There were some investments made through this special purpose appropriation for seniors to start addressing that gap. We have training that we've rolled out to our aging and disability resource connections. It is definitely a major need in addressing the mental health issues of the seniors in Oregon, and we definitely have more work to do in that area.
Continue.
Thank you. So I was mentioning financial exploitation as a type of abuse that continues to grow across Oregon, and oftentimes when someone is being financially exploited, there's another type of co-occurring abuse happening at the same time. And so on the slide, if you're interested in knowing a little more about financial exploitation, our Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations has put together this data book. And as an example, the report shows that the average victim in Oregon is a 77-year-old female, and that the abuse is often reported to Adult Protective Services by her banking institution. We've also implemented a statewide abuse reporting line, which you'll see there at the bottom. And this line is designed to get a consumer or somebody with a report of abuse in touch with an adult protective services worker in the most streamlined way possible. So I want to tell you a little bit about our adult protective services workers. These are our frontline investigators, and they're located in your communities. And they go out, they meet with consumers in their own homes, sometimes in facilities. And they're they were stationed, you know, in our aging and people with disabilities offices and our area agencies, some of our area agencies on aging across the state. And these employees are incredibly dedicated. They are out there every day. They have response times, so a call comes in and they have anywhere from 2 to 24 hours to respond, depending on what the allegation is. And they really step in to help isolated people who don't know where else to turn. And so, again, we're working really hard to identify areas for improvement. And I believe that Erin Kelly Seal mentioned yesterday that we're working to secure a statewide abuse reporting system that will really help us to be able to better serve Oregonians in this arena, and that project goes across programs and actually across agencies, and it's led through our Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, which you might hear referred to as OAPI.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A quick question. Who monitors and how does it work in an in-home foster care facility if there are, say, 3 or 4 people in there? How, you know, if they don't have their own phone or something like that, how do they facilitate a report of an abuse?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone. A couple of different ways. So the people working in the licensed adult foster home are mandatory reporters of abuse. So they would be required to report. And then a consumer, I believe through licensing, it's a requirement that they have a telephone available in a licensed foster home setting. And then also, they have access to the long-term care ombudsman, so that person would be able to come in and report or work with a consumer to report abuse. And also, we would have case managers who would be meeting every so often with consumers to ensure that their needs are being met, and that could be another way that abuse could be reported. And am I missing any of the?
You got it.
Okay.
Just a follow-up. I mean, this is a small setting.
Yes.
And if the abuser is the owner, for example, or something, how does that work? People fear retaliation, et cetera. But you know, what if something's happening, and the other, or they're not able to phone?
I'll help you.
Do they get pop-in investigative checkups, you know, like maybe a child care worker might do for a foster kid?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, we do unannounced visits of adult foster homes, and we also have some contacts with consumers that are in adult foster homes, which are unannounced. But I think we can acknowledge that the power dynamic exists in adult foster homes, and there very well may be situations where that sensitive exchange of information is very challenging to occur, and in some instances may not occur. So it's a difficult problem.
Okay. Co-chair.
Let me offer something that might help you a little bit too. Abuse can occur anywhere in the system, whether it's a nursing home, foster home, or assisted living facility. More likely to occur in a foster home or a nursing home because these people really can't speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. By and large, there just isn't a lot going on there. I'm much more worried about financial exploitation than anything else. Up to 2 or 3 years ago, the number of times foster homes were actually visited was pretty low, but the ombudsman program has really been expanded. Most of these homes are being seen 2 or 3 times a year by volunteers on a regular basis going in, and they've done a good job picking that up. Some of us physicians do that too. I make regular rounds on my foster homes and my nursing homes, seeing patients there, and you get a feel for what's going on. And family members can speak up too, of course. But most of these people, frankly, kind of lost track of their families in many, many cases. And so there is a risk, a significant risk for physical and emotional abuse. But by and large, the nursing homes, the foster homes are doing a great job. But look at the number of people in these situations. They're there's going to be occasionally a problem, and we have to be aware of that. So your question is spot on, and I tell you, I feel a lot better now than I did 3 or 4 years ago. The Longcare Ombudsman's Office has really stepped it up. The Jaegers have done a great job. I'm sorry to see them moving on, but I'm sure we'll get somebody else in there to do the same thing for us.
But we'll see them later this week.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're out of time here, though, aren't we?
This is our last slide on safety and protection. Thanks to the investment that was made by the legislature, we've been able to reduce the number of late cases total and late cases per investigator, while at the same time our numbers of allegations continues to go up. We saw a 10% increase in this last year. And finally, I want to mention work around Senate Bill 21. As you heard Erin Kelly Seal talk about yesterday, we have an ever-expanding older adult population. There will be 48% more older adults in 2020 than we had in 2010 in Oregon. And this is really exciting due to the contributions that older adults bring to our society. But it also can be challenging because we really want to be prepared to meet everyone's needs as they age and whatever those needs might be. So in 2013, Senate Bill 21 required the department to create a plan to improve the publicly funded long-term care system. And as you can see on the slide, the three main objectives were to help Oregonians achieve and maintain independence in a home or community-based setting, and to do so in a culturally responsive and equitable manner. So a great steering committee met for a number of months to come up with strategies under these main objectives, and they also proposed a timeline for implementation for a number of those strategies. The committee felt that it was really important to have a strong emphasis on research and data collection associated with any strategy that we attempt to implement together. And the strategies that came out as being really the most important and repeatedly came up were around housing, transportation, and caregiving issues. And then in the community, when we went out across the state to talk to Oregonians about the work of this committee, those three things also kept appearing, from the mouths of Oregonians as being really critical to them in, achieving independence or being able to stay in their own homes. So the link to the report is there on the slide on the left, and we hope that you'll read it if you're interested, and we look forward to continuing the conversation with you.
With that, we'll turn over to the normal three budget slides that we'll be seeing over and over in our presentations. The first slide is, again, a slide that's meant to represent that about 98% of the budget is a direct pay or service delivery outside of the system. We've got about 12% of the budget that goes into program delivery, which includes our state staff, field offices, our area agencies on aging, and a few other units. Program design is only 2% of the budget, and the remaining 86% of the budget is really programmed dollars that go directly out the door. 82% of that 86%, so minus the 4%, is really for nursing facilities, community-based care, and in-home services. On the next slide, again, with the fund types, we are greatly federally funded. 64% of our funds are from the feds. This is primarily Medicaid dollars with about $35 million worth of older American DACs funding coming in.
Interrupt for a minute here, because
sure.
I do hear a couple questions. Is that in thousands of millions?
Thousands. It's $1.75 billion,
yes,
of federal funds.
I think it's a little easier if you just put 1.75
sure.
B, because translating thousands of millions is always, it takes an extra second.
There's a comma instead of a minute. So that's it.
You're not always in the budget world that I'm living in.
They probably don't want to be. Keep going.
Yeah. Well said. About 7% of our budget is the other funds budget, which is primarily provider tax or provider assessments and estate recovery. The general fund is 29%, and it's almost used totally for match and maintenance of effort, as we talked about yesterday. The last budget slide is really showing the budget by program area. You can see that community-based care is about 25% of the budget. In-home services is about 27%. Nursing facilities is about 30%. And other services, which includes design and delivery, are the remaining 18% of that budget. So that would include programs like Oregon Project Independence and the Older Americans Act.
You used the phrase design and delivery. What's the design part of that?
So the design part of it is the more central office folks that are dealing with the programs, designing the programs, helping out the field and implementing the programs.
What we might call administrative overhead.
It could be called administrative overhead. There's other, we call it design.
That sounds fancy.
We have other parts that we would consider the overhead. In traditional terms.
Okay, thanks.
About 2%, right?
Of
design.
Design, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the bottom line is that we think we're on the right track. The governor's budget proposed continuing almost every new investment that was made in throughout these last 2 years. I think because I've, you know, as we've discussed, we've taken on a lot this biennium, and our focus that we're proposing for 15-17 is really trying to perfect all of the stuff that we've implemented this biennium, making sure that we're getting good data out of our systems, making sure that we've implemented quality. Everything is designed correctly, because it's just a simple case of volume of new initiatives that we had started this biennium. But I think hopefully you'll agree that the outcomes that we showed through this presentation is that we're on the right track. We're not asking for new programs or anything like that this time.
So you don't know about the J waivers?
Not aware of that.
Or L, whatever's
L,
next.
The L waivers.
All right, and the budget themes that Aaron discussed yesterday, a little preview of what's coming. Tomorrow we're going to be presenting the results of 7 legislative updates and or budget reports to all of you, and there will be a panel of presenters to present that information to you. On Monday, I will be presenting with my peer, Lilia Tennedy, the director of the Developmental Disabilities Program, to discuss the challenges that we're facing with the Department of Labor regulations as well as the Home and Community-Based Services regulations. And then Lilia will be giving an overview similar to what I did today for the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program on Tuesday. Questions?
We've been through any questions? I don't mind closing a meeting 4 minutes early. I'll take that, okay? So there's no questions. We are adjourned.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
Oh, no, it's okay.